Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Extreme gerrymander. A Utah judge rejects a GOP lawmaker's congressional map and picks districts favoring Democrats. The new apostle for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is European, cares about the environment, and knows a lot about the faith's finances. And Colorado River talks stall as Utah and other states miss a key deadline. Later in the program, we'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher-Stack and reporter Brooke Larson. Right now, we bring in Salt Lake Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thank you so much.
Yeah, good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Well, we've been talking about this on the last several programs. A lot of news happening here. We're talking about redistricting, right? I wonder if, you know, not go back to the mist of time, but I guess 2018 was when, it seems like a long time ago, Citizens of Utah passed an initiative, Better Boundaries Initiative on redistricting. Give us a little bit of the history at the beginning here.
Yeah, over 7 years ago now. It's been a while, but 2018 was the year that residents narrowly voted for this Better Boundaries Initiative. The goal was to create an independent redistricting commission to handle the decennial redistricting process and to ban partisan gerrymandering. A couple years later, the legislature, they didn't like that, and so they gutted a lot of the initiative, made the redistricting commission just an advisory commission, took out the language about partisan gerrymandering. The League of Women Voters, Mormon Women for Ethical Government, and a handful of voters who were impacted by that after the legislature split Salt Lake County four ways, just kind of carved up Mill Creek into, you know, pizza pie, challenged it in court, saying that it was unconstitutional for them to have overridden this citizen initiative. Initially, the judge in the case, Third District Judge Diana Gibson, disagreed, but then it got appealed to the Utah Supreme Court that said, no, they did violate the Constitution. Sent it back to Judge Gibson, who said Proposition 4, that Better Boundaries Initiative, was effective law. And because of that, the boundaries that the legislature had drawn that carved up Salt Lake County didn't comply with that, and they had to go back and do it again. The legislature put together a map that they submitted to the judge. The judge had a couple days of evidentiary hearings from experts on both sides who presented their case. And then on Monday night at about 11:45 p.m., right up at the last minute, issued a ruling that said that no, this map that the legislature submitted doesn't comply with Proposition 4 either. In fact, she said it was if you looked at 10,000 neutrally drawn maps using the criteria that are in Proposition 4, which is, you know, keep cities and counties intact, make the maps compact, contiguous, to preserve communities of interest. If you look at that criteria, this map behaves more like a Republican, is more favorable to Republicans than 9,994 out of 10,000 neutrally drawn maps. And so she said that's, you kind of led into it, an extreme outlier. She said it doesn't comply with Proposition 4, and she said that one can't be used. Then she looked at two maps that had been submitted by the plaintiffs in the lawsuit and said, okay, we're going to take the first of their two. That map essentially creates a northern Salt Lake County donut hole district. It's, you know, a small district in the northern portion of Salt Lake County surrounded by three large Republican-leaning districts. But that northern Salt Lake County district leans pretty heavily Democratic, and we can talk more about how much that is. I've been looking at that the last yesterday and the day before. But it does, for the first time in decades, give Democrats a not just a competitive seat, but a seat that is going to presumably be leaning in their direction. Now, the legislature obviously is not happy about this. They had made some noise about an appeal. We still haven't seen that. We don't know what's going to happen with that. So, but the clock on this is really ticking. The Lieutenant Governor's office said that they needed a map in place no later than November 10th. So we're past that deadline already now. So if there's an appeal, it could really complicate things from the electoral side of things. If the map stays in place, as I mentioned, it favors Democrats, and we've already started seeing some Democratic hopefuls getting into the race.
This was plaintiff map number one, I believe. So, yes, tell us what the new district has a Democratic lean, quite a good for Democrats lean.
Yeah. So it includes those what you think of as the traditional blue islands in red Utah. It's got Salt Lake City, West Valley, Kearns, Magna, Mill Creek, South Salt Lake, Cottonwood. It goes down to Cottonwood Heights. All of these are pretty favorable to Democrats, depending on which election you're looking at. This is let's put it this way. Trump ran three times in Utah. He lost in this district by 24 points, 23, 24 points. So to Harris, Biden, and to Hillary Clinton. That's not to say that this is a 23, 24 point favorite for Democrats. There are other races. Governor Cox, for example, last year when he ran in it, lost it by about 11 points, 11 and a half points to former state rep Brian King. And that includes about 8% of the vote that went to Phil Lyman. So you can see that would just be a few points advantage for a Democrat. So where is it? If we look at races going back to 2016, it's about between about a 14 and 17 point Democratic advantage is sort of where I'm putting it at, which is, again, that's a pretty healthy edge, right? If you're running a 100-meter race and you've got a 17-meter head start, you know, you're in pretty good shape. But it's not, as some have said, you know, one of the most Democratic leaning districts in the country, not by a long shot. It's probably down around, you know, 115th in terms of that.
Before we go on, I'd like to talk just a little bit about the crux of the dispute between the legislature and the judiciary here.
Yeah.
Legislature keeps saying that the Constitution gives them final say in redistricting. And like, there is a phrase in the Constitution, which will lead you to believe that the Utah Supreme Court says, well, legislature, you have to comply when the citizens run an initiative and it passes.
Yeah, there's two things. The legislature points to Article 9 of the Utah Constitution that says every 10 years the legislature shall draw political boundaries. I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but that's the gist of it. And they say, based on that, the judge is overstepping, ignoring the Constitution and imposing her will on the legislature, and they think that's improper. The judge in her ruling addressed that to some degree and said that that's more about when they draw it, not that they draw it, that they draw it every 10 years. And that's sort of putting a time constraint on when they can draw boundaries. The other thing that is sort of key here is that they shall draw the maps, but they also have to draw the maps in accordance with other parts of the law. You know, they can't just ignore any of the provisions that were in Prop 4 or, you know, the law before that. They have to comply with the law. And if they don't, then the courts can step in and reject the maps that the legislature has drawn because they haven't done it, as I said, in accordance with the law. And that's what the judge contends happened here. And given that we were up against this deadline that the LG said, you know, the map having to be in place by November 10th, Judge Gibson said she reluctantly is fulfilling her obligation to make sure that there is a compliant map in place for the 2026 elections. And that's how she rationalized or justified the decision that she made to choose that plaintiff's map.
Now, in this court case, there were dueling redistricting experts, I believe.
Yeah.
What did they say? What was the essence of the dispute between the experts?
Yeah, so it's important to note that so each side had brought three experts. The judge said that she was persuaded pretty heavily by the plaintiff's expert, Dr. Chen. He's a University of Michigan statistician and political science professor. And he's the one who produced that ensemble of 10,000 maps that showed that, in his opinion, that the map that the legislature submitted was a Republican gerrymander. The state's experts, one of them was Sean Trendy, who is an elections analyst, and he is the one who actually drew Map C, the map that the legislature ended up selecting. One of the big, stumbling blocks for that map was that he admitted during the court hearing that he had drawn that map with part of the program he used was displaying partisan data when he was doing it. He said it didn't influence him, it was worthless, but he acknowledged that it was there, and that's explicitly prohibited in the in Proposition 4. That was one of the things that that Judge Gibson pointed to in rejecting the map. Another one was that, you know, Dr. Trendy's he also made I think he made over 200,000 maps with this computer algorithm, and these computer algorithms can spit these out in a matter of a couple days. But a lot of his the maps that his computer algorithm spit out did like carved up districts in weird ways, sometimes splitting as many as 13 counties. Some of the districts kind of snaked all over the state. They weren't really compliant with the other portions of Proposition 4, Prop 4. And so the judge just kind of just said that she didn't put a lot of stock in his testimony. And so that was kind of the gist of it. There was also a professor from Brigham Young University, Michael Barber, who testified on behalf of the state. She thought he was compelling in some of his testimony. One of the things that he said that she seemed to appreciate or grasp onto was that he said that, you know, if he was analyzing these proposals, he wouldn't limit his analysis to just a couple of tests. He would try to use, you know, look at all of the tools in his toolbox and then apply the tests that work best. And that was significant because the legislature had tried to limit what tests the judge could use, and she thought these tests were not good and actually applied together, as the plaintiffs argued. She accepted their argument that applied together, that would guarantee a mandate that you end up with a map that has four safe Republican districts. So she discarded those tests, used a more, as she put it, a holistic approach, and that's how we ended up getting to the spot where she said the legislature's map is a gerrymander. I'm going to choose this other map.
So Republicans aren't done, right? Legislators, they say they probably appeal. Have we heard on that?
Yeah, so before the judge's ruling Monday night, the legislature had said on several occasions that they disagreed that they should have been told that they had to redraw the maps, and they intended to appeal that decision. Since the ruling, they haven't actually said that they are going to appeal, and so it's a little bit unclear what they're doing. I contacted probably a half dozen legislators yesterday trying to get an answer to that question, if they're going to appeal or not. It's possible that they appeal, but the map stays in place for 2026. Also, the Republican Party, the state Republican Party, as we talked about last week, is running this initiative petition that is trying to repeal Proposition 4 entirely. And they think that if there's an initiative that repeals Proposition 4, then that trumps an initiative, and you don't run into the problems with the legislature doing it and trying to undo the statute. Also, we should probably mention that Representative Matt McPherson and Representative Trevor Lee have been making noise that they want to impeach Judge Gibson for violating her oath of office and ignoring the Constitution. That was something that they kind of threw out there late Monday night, like minutes after the ruling came out. There hasn't been a bill file opened on that we can see yet, and so it's a little unclear what the support is like for that in the body. But if that happens, I mean, that would be the first time, as far as we can tell, the first time that a judge has been would have been impeached. And impeached, I should note, there was one case with a judge who was facing some drug charges, and they brought articles of impeachment against him, and the judge resigned. This would be the first time that a judge would be impeached for something that the legislature just disagreed with, for issuing a ruling that they fundamentally thought was wrong. And so that would be kind of an unusual precedent, but you know, we'll see if that gets support going forward.
So if that initiative gains enough signatures, that would be on the ballot next November.
Correct. The Republican Party's had now 14 town hall meetings around the state, and so they're in the process now of beginning to gather signatures. They've got until February 15th, I believe, is the deadline to get those signatures in. They have to get over nearly 141,000 valid signatures from spread all across the state. And if they do get that, then the repeal question will go on the ballot in 2026. Obviously, too late to, you know, impact it for this first election cycle. But that would repeal Proposition 4, and then the legislature would be free to kind of go back and redo the maps again, start all over.
The lieutenant governor says she'll use this map that the judge approved unless an appeals court blocks her. So I guess we'll proceeding on plaintiff map number one.
Yeah, she gave me a statement the other day that said, you know, I was asking, is November 10th actually the drop dead deadline, or is there wiggle room? And she said, no, November 10th is the drop dead deadline. They were a little alarmed at the time I asked this, because that was on November 12th and they still hadn't received the map from the court, but they did get the official file yesterday and are progressing based on the assumption that this will be the map in place for 2026, unless, like you said, they hear otherwise from an appellate court.
So at least two Democrats have thrown their hat in the ring for this district. Tell me about that.
Right. State Senator Kathleen Reby was kind of the first to jump into the race. She announced on Wednesday morning that she was going to run for the seat. She says that, you know, she ran for in the special election after Representative Chris Stewart retired for that seat that Celeste Malloy ended up winning. So she's getting back into the race. And then yesterday, former Congressman Ben McAdams announced that he was running. We knew that he was going to do that because we received an invitation to his kickoff event that was held last night a few days earlier. So that was kind of cat was out of the bag on that one, so to speak. And so those two are running. There are a couple others. State Senator Nate Bluin has said that he's considering it. Caroline Gleick, who ran for U.S. Senate last year, has said that she's been encouraged to run and is talking about it with her family. And there are a couple others who are sort of, you know, maybe lesser known, but also rumored to be considering it as well. So I think when you have gone so long without a congressional seat that favors your party, there's a lot of pent up interest and ambition that is going to be coming out, and it has the potential to be a very crowded field. And also, you know, it's interesting. One of the things is, if we talk about Ben specifically, Ben McAdams kind of made a name for himself being a moderate who could win in Republican districts. That doesn't necessarily work to his advantage in a more liberal district, a progressive district that may not be keen on his sort of moderate track record or moderate persona. So that could potentially be a challenge for him, but that's something we'll watch and see how it plays out over the next, what is the primaries in June, I think. So we've got some time.
So people running for Congress don't have to live in the district. So
correct.
We currently have four Congress people, Republicans. Which is the odd person out? Which Republican is going to have the tougher race?
That's a really interesting question, too, and one that I think... but what I'm hearing right now is that they're still waiting to see if this map is the one that ends up being used. You know, they're not committing to anything yet. Representative Blake Moore there's a Northern Utah district, that is kind of in line with what the district is that Representative Moore is representing now. And so that's the one that he's going to be running in. There's a Southwestern district, but there's also a Southeastern district that kind of wraps around part of the Southwest. So we could see Celeste Malloy and Michael Kennedy run in either of those. Right now, it looks like Representative Burgess Owens is the one who's sort of in a pickle, right? He's probably geographically closest to that first district, the Democratic leaning one, but it's unlikely, I think, that he would throw his hat into that one, just because, as we've talked about, it favors Democrats by such a large margin. So you could have a scenario where you have either Michael Kennedy running against Celeste Malloy in one of those districts, or you have Burgess Owens running against Kennedy or Malloy. That's still stuff that we're all kind of waiting to see shake out. Representative Owens has said that he intends to run again, but right now the question is, okay, where? And so they've got to work that out, and I think they're kind of waiting to work that out until there's some certainty that this is indeed going to be the map that's going to be used in 2026.
Finally on this, Robert, this case and this ruling only applied to congressional districts, right? But better boundaries could affect other maps, right?
Yeah, and I'm to be honest, I'm a little surprised nobody's done that yet. So when this lawsuit was filed, it only challenged the congressional maps, and part of the reason for that, frankly, was that the Democrats in the legislature voted mostly in favor of the Senate and the House maps. But you know, applying this logic, and I, you know, the attorney who represented the League of Women Voters and Mormon Women for Ethical Government in this case confirms that he thinks that, yeah, if somebody wanted to file suit and saying that those maps don't comply with Proposition 4, it's, he didn't call it a slam dunk, but they could do that. The same logic would apply, and it could have those maps thrown out. That would obviously be something that would not be able to be enacted by 2026. It would be something further on down the road. But yeah, those, the state Senate, state House, state school board seats, none of them comply with Proposition 4 because they weren't drawn in accordance with it, and presumably could be susceptible to a challenge as well.
We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke, telling us about all of this. Robert, before we let you go on to the next segment, do you have an underplayed story?
Yeah, it's not, I guess it's not necessarily underplayed, but it's a story that posted this morning by Courtney Tanner. She'd done some reporting previously on the spending, the lavish spending of the former Utah State University president, who spent over $600,000 in about a year and a half on things like tables and cars and things like that. The university is now putting into place policies that will review the spending of the university president to try to put a check on that. I just kind of want to flag this because sometimes we write stories that kind of go into the ether, but this is one where you can actually see that there's being a real profound direct impact on the way that things are going to be run at the university going forward. And so I think that's worth checking out at sltrib.com.
sltrib.com for those. Yeah, thank you. Appreciate that,
yeah,
Robert.
Absolutely.
Well, behind the headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune will continue following a break. We'll be talking in the next segment with senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. Here's the headline: the new apostle for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is European, cares about the environment, and knows a lot about the faith's finances. Robert, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, happy to be here. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thanks, everyone. Hope you'll stay with us for the rest of Behind the Headlines. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. In this part of the program, we'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. Peggy, thanks so much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Good to have you on. Here's the headline: the new apostle for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is European, cares about the environment, and knows a lot about the faith's finances. So you were able to sit down with Elder Cosse, and you have a story all about him here. So, Gerald Cosse, give us the highlights. Who is he?
Apostle Cosse was born in Bordeaux, France, as actually a second generation Latter-day Saints. His parents joined the Utah-based faith when he was just 6 months old. So he was raised in France in a tiny little Latter-day Saint congregation. Eventually moved to Paris, where he met his wife, or dated his wife. I don't know all the ins and outs of that, and married. And he was a businessman, and I think he managed some supermarkets or something, a chain. And then he was called to be what the church describes as an area authority. And so he ended up living in Germany and, you know, some other places in Europe, and then eventually was brought into a leadership position with what is called as the presiding bishopric, which is the three-man leadership team that oversees the church's financial holdings and humanitarian efforts. It's essentially its sort of material holdings. And so he served as that for a long time. Let's see how long. And then he ended up becoming the top guy of the actual presiding bishop. And now he goes to be the apostle.
He joins two other European apostles.
He does indeed, which is interesting.
Right.
Of the 12 apostles, now three of them are European. Dietrich of Germany and Patrick Kieran of the UK and now Elder Kosei.
So he was, I guess you could call him the top, there's a sub-headline here in the Tribune says the church's money man, top financial officer. And the church, you know, famously has pretty significant holdings.
It does indeed. And he's been overseeing that. Obviously, there's been some controversy about it, given how much money the church has, which is literally in the billions. He's had to explain that to the public, and he's always said, well, the church, you know, does have a lot of resources, but it always uses its resources to help people and to support the church's mission, that sort of thing. He told the Wall Street Journal, we have a vision of the church that is, can I use the word grandiose? We believe the gospel has to be taken to all the world. And so we see the size of the church with 17.5 million members, multiple times what it is now in the future. That's how he has explained it, the reason for all the financial resources the church has.
Another subheadline here highlights another issue that Elder Kosei has highlighted. A green apostle is the subheadline. So he has spoken out with the earth, right? Taking care of the earth, sustainability?
He absolutely has. In fact, when I interviewed him, he became most passionate when talking about that. He outlined six major sustainability priorities at a conference in Brazil, using renewable resources, conserving water, avoiding material waste, improving air quality, practicing sustainable designs, and engaging in sustainable farming practices. He considers that, as he told me in the interview, loving God and loving your neighbor, the two great commandments, include loving the earth's creations and how it affects people. But also just care for the earth is a big one of his priorities.
Also in that interview, you asked, I'll just quote, when asked about what more could be done to elevate women in the church. So you asked him about that. What did he say?
He didn't really answer that. He just said he's loved serving with women, that they've been on committees and full partners and decision-making, and he believes in the strengths of women, but is waiting for more direction from President Oaks. This President Oaks is the one who said that meaning the church, needs to do more. And when I asked him about that, he just said he's open. He doesn't exactly know what more needs to be done, but he's happy to be tutored by President Oaks.
I want to hit a couple of more highlights from your interview. You asked him if he'd like to see a sustainability calling in every ward. I guess a person, the idea would be to oversee sustainability in the local congregations.
He just said, I didn't think about that. He said, that was kind of my question. Mm-hmm. Some people have raised it with me. And he just says there's no reason not to, but if a local bishop wants to do it, but there's no plan to make that a church-wide thing, as far as he knew.
You asked him how the church could be more welcoming to same-sex couples. What was his response?
He essentially said that this church's position on same-sex couples, he supports it, which is that it's okay to be, it's not a sin to be gay or LGBTQ plus, but acting on it is. And he just said he supports that position, but he believes that every son and daughter of God has a genuine chance and opportunity to live the gospel. So he didn't give me very specific answers about that.
You brought up President Oaks putting a pause on temple building. The predecessor, President Nelson, had been prolific in announcing and setting in motion temple building. What did he say about this pause?
He said that people had said to him afterwards, "Oh, does that mean you don't have any work to do anymore?" And he joked, he said, "Well, we do have to finish building the 172 temples that are sort of in the process." And he said, when I asked him if more would be announced, he said, "That's the prerogative of President Oaks." He wasn't going to say anything, but they definitely still have work to do.
So in your story, you sought out reactions to the appointment of Elder Cossey to the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles. What were people saying?
As far as we could tell, he's well-liked. People called him generous and kind and patient and that sort of thing. As far as I know, I wasn't alone in that. I have my two colleagues were working on it with me. And again, pretty high marks from most people. Didn't get, as far as I can tell, too much negative feedback. That people said he was, as I said, generous, kind, open, capable, hardworking, those kind of adjectives people used.
So
people are excited that he speaks French,
mm-hmm.
because the church is really growing a lot in French-speaking Africa, and they think having a French-speaking apostle, though not African, will still connect to some of those people. So that was something we heard a lot.
So I guess just to review for those who don't know, apostle, there are 12 apostles, the second highest governing body in the church under the first presidency. So Elder Cossey will now serve until he dies.
Essentially, yes, it's a lifetime position. So he will, he's 62 now. If he lives the same length as a lot of other apostles, he's looking at 20 plus more years of service.
So still no word. I guess we wouldn't have word yet on who will replace him as presiding bishop.
No, we don't.
Mm-hmm. Anything else you'd like to say about the new apostle, Gerald Cossey?
It was a pleasure to meet him. He was warm and open and smiling and responsive. I'll be interested to cover him as an apostle now.
Well, we've had with us in this part of the program Salt Lake Tribune senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack, telling us about the new apostle for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Peggy, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you. And we'll go to break now, and when we come back, we'll be having a conversation with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson. Here's the headline: Colorado River talks stall as Utah and other states miss a key deadline. Hope you stay with us through the break for Behind the Headlines, weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. And in this part of the program, we bring in Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson. Brooke, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. Here's the headline: Colorado River talks stall as Utah and other states miss a key deadline. So I guess that's the place to start. What was that deadline?
Yeah, so the Interior Department had set a November 11th deadline for the seven states in the Colorado River Basin to come up with a preliminary agreement on the future management of the river. And they didn't have any agreement to present publicly. Jean Shawcroft, Utah's Colorado River commissioner, said that they came to, enough of a conceptual agreement on sort of a framework going forward that the federal government won't step in and make a plan for them instead. But we couldn't get any clear answers on sort of what the agreement at this point does entail.
So what, there is another deadline in February of next year?
Yep. So, the federal government had set a deadline of November 11th for sort of a preliminary agreement and then mid-February for, a final agreement from the states, a more fleshed out plan that then the federal government would go through deeper analysis and environmental review of. So, next step will be this February deadline. Hopefully, the states can reach an agreement by then and have a more fleshed out plan.
The problem, as I understand it, is that the current agreement runs out end of next year. So that's the real deadline, I guess.
Yeah, so currently the Colorado River Compact goes back up to over a century. So that's kind of the law of the river, but in the early 2000s, when the Colorado River Basin started experiencing pretty intense drought, the states needed some new guidelines of how to manage this river in times of shortage, since the compact really didn't account for the level of drought that we have now. And so there were these interim guidelines created in 2007. And since then, there's been, a drought contingency plan in 2019, some like short-term operations, that were approved, early 2024 to get through the end of next year. So we've had these various short-term guidelines put in place of how to manage the river in times of shortage. And so that's really what they are talking about right now, is what are the new guidelines of how to manage the river in times of shortage. And the tricky thing is, climate scientists are showing that this is likely just the reality of the river. This isn't sort of a short-term thing anymore. So it's a challenging conversation, just giving the reality of the river now.
One thing that stood out to me from your story, Brooke, is one of the experts, I can't remember their name, they said we shouldn't even call it a crisis anymore. It's just the ongoing situation.
Yeah, that was Sarah Porter. She's the director of a water policy center at Arizona State University. And yeah, I thought that was a really interesting take, because we hear a lot like the Colorado River is in crisis, and we certainly have these short-term moments where just the infrastructure we have at Glen Canyon Dam, Hoover Dam, just can't accommodate for the low river levels. So we have these short-term crisis moments, but we also have this long-term reality. We've known the river's been over-allocated for a while now, and I thought that was an interesting take she had of, we need to stop viewing it as a crisis, and this is the reality, and we need to manage accordingly.
So the Colorado River serves seven states, of course, Mexico as well. Some people may know the Upper Basin, Lower Basin, but that's really the dispute, isn't it? Upper Basin versus Lower Basin states. So remind us, which are the Upper Basin states and which are the Lower Basin?
Yeah, so the Upper Basin includes Utah, Wyoming, New Mexico, and Colorado. So those are, the states upstream of Glen Canyon Dam. And then we have Arizona, California, and Nevada in the Lower Basin.
So,
And sorry, I think you asked the dispute between them. Did you want me to speak part of that?
the dispute, yes.
Yeah, so they basically upstream, of Glen Canyon Dam, there are not these massive reservoirs like Lake Powell and, Lake Mead, just a little ways down. And so a lot of states like Utah have to manage water year by year based on snowpack, how much is in this stream, this smaller river that eventually flows into the larger Colorado River Basin. And so the upper basin states argue they're already taking cuts every year, just based on the flows in these waterways. The Colorado River Compact divided how much the upper and basin, upper and lower basin get from the Colorado River at 7.5 million acre feet, which, you know, is a lot of water. That's their allocation. The upper basin has not used their allocation. They're in recent years have used closer around 4.6, I think was the number I saw, the average, the past few years. And so they're using less. So they argue they shouldn't have to take, you know, any more cuts like during these times of shortages. The lower basin, on the other hand, has been using historically either all of their allocation of the Colorado River, sometimes even more. But they, in these, you know, interim guidelines that the river has been operating on, have had mandatory cuts when the river's low. And so the lower basin has cut their use. You know, California's cut their use pretty substantially. And so there's this argument, this tension that the lower basin has been doing the work that, and that the upper basin also has an obligation to deliver water downstream. And there's, this kind of gets into wonky legal details, but there's some different interpretations of what the upper basin's obligation is. And that is sort of the tension point that is holding up these talks and that may lead to lawsuits down the line.
Yes, I learned some phrases from your story. the upper basin believes they just have a non-depletion obligation, right? To just not deplete too much of it. Lower basin believes they have a delivery obligation. You got to hit that 7.5 million acres or whatever, acre feet or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
One of the big disputes, it sounds like, is that the lower basin states have really made some progress. At least they're saying they made a lot of progress on conservation, and they don't think the upper basin states are doing as much as they should.
Yeah. So, I mean, like I was kind of just saying, the lower basin, you know, has had mandatory cuts they've had to take. Some of it has been voluntary on their part in times of shortages. And so they would like to see the upper basin have some enforceable conservation as well. And this is just goes back to that the lower basin believes no matter what, you know, there is that sort of, there's like a 10-year rolling average of how much the upper basin is supposed to deliver, is their interpretation. And like you just said, the upper basin believes they just aren't supposed to deplete. And there's these other factors now, right? Like climate change, that's actually drawing the river down. And so that's the tension. And the upper basin, you know, has conserved water. We in Utah, you know, a lot of people have removed their lawns. There's incentives for farmers to conserve and things like that. But the lower basin would really like to see the upper basin have mandatory enforceable cuts they have to take in times of shortage, rather than just how it's currently been managed, which is essentially, you know, each state is regulating each waterway. And if the runoff's low in that year, you know, someone may have to take cuts back, but it's not at sort of this basin-wide scale.
So the history in the last 10 years or so has been a new agreement every 3 to 5 years. Is that how it's just going to go? We won't have one big new water compact. We'll just take another bite at the apple every 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, this last set of guidelines for times of, you know, water shortages that was in 2007. So, you know, those are going through the end of 2026. That's, you know, a 20-year plan that was made last time. I think it, I have heard various answers to that in terms of what this time frame of we can expect. I've heard, yeah, it could just be 5 years, it could be 20 years. I think because these talks are so contentious, you know, some of these water managers would love a longer term plan. But I also heard even if they come to a 20-year agreement, that the forecasts for next year for the Colorado River are so dire that there will likely have to even be some very short-term agreements made just to prevent water at Lake Powell dropping to dangerously low levels.
One of the lower basin water commissioners, I can't remember, California or Arizona, probably, said that the lower basin is closer than they've ever been to suing the upper basin over this.
Yeah, I mean the I think for some states, and the state I've heard speak out most on this is Arizona. You know, Governor Katie Hobbs wrote a letter to Interior Secretary Doug Burgum, as well as the state's legislative leaders, calling on them to step in, lead these talks, and make sure any agreement includes enforceable action for the upper basin in terms of cuts. And if they can't come to an agreement, a lawsuit is a real possibility. Sarah Porter, who we mentioned some of what she was talking about earlier, so that could be a real possibility in the next few years if they can't come to an agreement. Because if the upper basin does not deliver that, 10-year rolling average that they're supposed to in the compact, this 100-year-old act, then the lower basin, could take them to court. So that's sort of what is the larger thing at risk here, is that if the states can't come to an agreement, lawsuits could be very likely in the next few years.
Finally, on this, a key part of this is are the two dams, right? And the reservoirs. And we've had headlines over the last few years about dangerously low water levels at both reservoirs.
So Lake Powell, is only 29% full, and forecasts, the minimum probable forecasts, Bureau of Reclamation puts out these forecasts, what the river is looking like for the next 24 months. And some of the recent forecasts show that it could reach below 3,500 feet, which is the level that experts in the Interior Department have said we really don't want the river or the lake dropping below this level, because at that point air can, get into the turbines on Glen Canyon Dam and damage the infrastructure, and that infrastructure provides, generates electricity for a lot of homes across Utah and other states in the West. So, yeah, it's pretty high stakes in terms of keeping the lake up above that level.
Well, we'll end it there, out of time. By the way, another interesting story we didn't have time for in this segment. We'll urge people to go to sltrib.com and read this one. Here's the headline: Inside the fight to save a beloved Utah recreation area as Northern Corridor Highway plans take a new turn. We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson. Brooke, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
And you have been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Hope you'll be with me again next time.